You may approach me, Panal.
Huitzel approached Lee, spoke to the figure cringing in the shadows of his personal audience chamber. He sat upon his gold throne with the concealed gel cushion in his own semblance, which he always liked to think was more than impressive, what with his hard-muscled frame and square-jawed handsomeness and all. Bobbing his head, Pinal stepped out into the light from behind the large fern. The foliage was Coatlicue's idea. For his part, Huitzilopochtli was pretty indifferent to green-growing things. He had sneered at his brother Tezcatlipoca's suggestion that the plants might conceal assassins. Why should he, the primary war god, concern himself with such, when at the least flicker of his own intention any assassin's blade would shatter on contact with his divine skin? But then Tezcatlipoca always chose to walk the coward's path, as he had shown these past few days, hanging back from the forefront of battle, keeping his own precious jaguar knights as safe as drops of his own blood. Of course, he always had some plausible and even resounding explanation. He labored around the clock on some new twist of science that would confound their enemies. One of the two must remain behind to guard Talokan itself against the rebels' treacherous schemes. And was it not meet that the honor and glory of taking the field against the usurper Quetzalcoatl should go to the primary war god, Hummingbird, upon the left? That last, of course, wasn't even a rationalization. As Pinal came forward, Huitzilopochtli cast a covert glance at his brother god, standing upon his own left hand. How like Tezcatlipoca to twist even the most resplendent truth to his own dark ends! As Pinal, the chief propagandist, spoke, he made washing motions of one paper-white hand against the other.
Master, forgive your humblest servant. How was I to know that people would be outraged by our claiming credit for the deaths today, in the city and parliament? Should it not have made them tremble in their hearts for fear of your divine retribution for treason and heresy?
Yes, it should. That was why I had demanded his voice propound that view. Or was it Coatlicue's idea? No matter. What other reason to give divinity to creatures of Pinal's ilk, if not to absorb blame that might otherwise tarnish the luster of the great Huitzilopochtli? Speaking of luster, after I slay that gringo whelp Tonatia, I'll proclaim myself sole and primary sun god as well. Am I not a solar deity too? Then let's see them reincarnate that crappy little Mayan import. And when we expand our sway beyond the valley, the first thing I'll do is go and wipe out those Mayan magas in Yucatan. The very names are practically the same. Mayan, Mayate, Maggot. They're all ugly little pricks anyway. They look like muties before there were any. Probably byblows of some damn Anunnaki experiment or other. They're not really human at all.
Behind him, the war god heard a soft step. Pinal, now groveling on his knees before Huitzilopochtli, looked up, his face locked into its tragic aspect. Huitzilopochtli turned his head. His blessed mother stood there. He hadn't known she was lurking behind the throne. Even to him, who was literal-minded, it seemed too literal-minded. Not for the first time, he wondered if she had the ability to auto-teleport. Coatlicue jealously guarded the true extent and nature of her powers, even, or perhaps especially, from her own offspring. Or maybe she had just had another secret passage built into the pyramid. Or was it Tezcatlipoca? He had designed the structure himself on computers brought by the exiles, overseen its construction while Huitzilopochtli perfected his skill in the manly arts of war. Coatlicue had always favored Huitzilopochtli. Yet it did not mean she and the clever smoking mirror might not share secrets withheld from him. There was no doubt that Coatlicue was assiduous that neither son, no matter how strong he became, grew so strong he might think to do without her.
I'll show her, too. I will. Someday.
Pinal, you have served your lord and master ill.
She was really quite beautiful, with her dark red metallic hair, immense glowing green eyes, the skin cinnamon-hued velvet on her ripe, bare breasts and flat belly. Not even the baby's skull she wore as a pendant detracted from her beauty. Pinal all but melted into the polished granite floor in self-abasement.
Oh, please, please, O Mother of the Stars of the Southern Sky, spare me! I atone! I atone!
She reached two fingers, tipped with nails painted the color of fresh blood, and with the tips of the curving nails touched him beneath the chin. With slight, insistent pressure, she first drew up his head, then brought him to his feet.
There, there, dear Pinal. Am I not the mother of all the true gods? Not merely the paramount pair who sprang from my own loins? How can I not nurture and cherish you as my own child?
His face became the idiot's mask of joy.
Then you forgive me, great Coatlicue? You will spare Pinal?
No!
The beaten gold rattlesnakes with garnet eyes that hung from her belt to make up her skirt became flesh, lived, reared up and hissed, showing miniature but fully venomed fangs. Pinal stumbled back away from the throne. His patent leather shoes got tangled and he sat down hard, holding a splayed hand up before him in a futile bid to ward off doom. Coatlicue spread her arms. Her large and flawless breasts rode up on her ribcage as she raised her arms, the chocolate-dropped nipples becoming hard, her perfect teeth parted between red lips. A low tone began to vibrate through the chamber, rising in volume and in pitch, rising, rising like a huge infrasound wand powering up. The vibrations seemed to focus on the spot where Pinal was sitting. Even sitting to the side, out of the direct path of the sound, Huitzilopochtli's teeth were set on edge. He ground his jaw, dissatisfied with this turn of events. He risked a sideways look at his brother. Tezcatlipoca stood with arms folded, wearing a disdainful smile, the same as always. But it seemed he leaned forward with just an extra glitter to his eye. The noise rose to the point of pain. The throne quivered with sympathetic vibrations beneath Huitzilopochtli's divine fundament, and the leaves and fronds of some of the plants began to wither and droop. Face, once again a parody of sorrow, Pinal reared back, holding out both hands. Given that he seemed no more than an animated pen and ink cartoon, with his black and white face and black and white suit, what happened next was in a way appropriate. The stuff of him seemed to be smeared this way and that in lines undulating from high to low, as if some giant eraser were attempting to rub him out. His own voice rose to a scream as shrill and wild as the awful vibration. Just as the drone passed the threshold beyond which human ears could not pass, Pinal simply flew apart into nothing, as if he had never been, leaving nothing behind except, inexplicably, his shoes.
Now I call that atonement.
Huitzilopochtli felt his lips press into a pout.
Why did you have to do that, Mother? I liked that by now.
There, there, dear. I will make you a new one. When we rebuild Tenochtitlan in our own image.
When we rebuild the world in our own image, no?
Huitzilopochtli glanced at him, his sorrow for the loss of his pet almost transmuted to floppy gratitude. Even the cynical Tezcatlipoca showed solidarity with their grand design now. It almost made his deprivation worthwhile. He reached up and patted his mother's hand on his shoulder and reminded himself sternly that big gods didn't cry.
Sir, we have a problem.
The departing sun's slanting rays turned all within the room to fire. Even in its orange glare, the young man who had spoken closely resembled a raccoon. It was not an aspect, nor sign of taint. It was just that none of the Institute's intel analysts had gotten more than the rare 15-minute sleep since a day or so after Kane's arrival, monitoring the complex situation in Tenochtitlan and the actions of Talokan. The Contemplation Conversation Lounge had become the Outlander God's squad room, more or less by default. The buffet had been set up again and left. In human guise, Domi crouched on a table, gnawing a roasted chicken. She nodded at the television. It was switching from scene to scene of combat. After the crowd turned on Talokan, its surviving sekmen had battled their way back to the city's ruling center. Hundreds had been lost, but the ruling gods commanded thousands more. These had broken forth half an hour earlier in a concerted thrust toward Tlian Tlapayan, and the core of Quetzalcoatl resistance behind a phalanx of eagle and jaguar knights. With their polycarbonate armor and shields, the knights were ideal riot control troops. Not that they troubled with any soft-hearted non-lethal crowd control weps or tactics. Instead, they flash-blasted everyone in their path with auto-blasters and a leavening of lasers and plasma rifles, and anyone who managed to come within arm's reach got the chop from the resin-enforced obsidian blades of a sword. That cleared out the congestion in the streets quick enough. The people of Tenochtitlan were feisty and fully pissed off, but neither bulletproof nor stupid. But a city fight was a slow fight. The sect men of the districts, now friendly to Quetzalcoatl, most of them now, had upon consultation with Don Exildo, deployed in hardened positions within and atop buildings to defend in depth against just this sort of assault. And while no one was going to confuse General Martinez with a military genius, he wasn't a duffer either. He had not omitted to sow sniper teams liberally in the path of a possible breakout. Since their armor wasn't full body, even the magistrate-like knights were vulnerable to very well-placed shots, and the sectmen following them had no armor other than their shirts. So the battle went. Inexorably, the Talokan forces advanced towards the Institute, but it was progress yard by yard, and each one bought with blood. But so far, Talokan had committed none of its gods. As far as Kane could see, it all amounted to a kind of dynamic stalemate in which none could gain a clear advantage. It reminded him of ancient vids he'd seen of the team sport called soccer, lots of running around, but nothing actually ever happening. Losing interest in the newcomer and his news, Domi went back to trying to describe certain facets of the local scene to Bridget in between bites of her chicken.
So like Xolotl, he's the lightning god, and Chantico, she's kind of a volcano goddess. They're on our side. They're out there now, but they won't show themselves unless some of Talokan's big guns turn up.
Bridget sat at the computer, her face shaded from the light of the falling sun and hence illuminated by the pallid glow of information.
What about them, Domi?
They're lovers.
Lovers?
Yeah. Well, see, they both have dog's heads, so it's kind of natural if you think about it.
But I don't want to. Domi, you have helped me discover, belatedly, that even for a senior archivist whose very life is research, there's such a thing as too much information. Thank you.
Whatever.
What is our problem, then, Chuchakwala?
Kane put his hand to his face, smiling. The local name still took some getting used to.
The people are calling out for Quetzalcoatl. Reports flood in from every district. There is even murmuring in Talokan itself. If Quetzalcoatl appears, he will be acclaimed. The two will find it very hard to resist coming to terms.
Thank you very much. You may go.
The young man steepled his fingers and bowed a quick, shallow bow. Then he turned and walked back to his unit.
But we're fresh out of Quetzalcoatl's today, aren't we?
You know, Grant, you're taking this all mighty easy.
Domi tossed her skeletonized bird toward a trash receptacle 10 whole yards across the room without hitting anything but the bottom of the bin. The powers of Itzapapalotl were making her insufferable in some ways.
Domi, this is all so far off my radar scope I can't even see it. So why work myself into a state? I'm just a mag at heart. Tell me where to go and who to shoot and leave everything else to admin and the white goats.
Well, Grant, I guess you got more sense than any of us.
Took you this long to figure that out?
Bridget turned in her swivel chair.
So, what do we do now?
Looks like you need to make yourselves a new Quetzalcoatl.
Domi was now studying the buffet, trying to decide what to eat next. As Itzapapalotl, her already considerable appetite really was insatiable, and she would now eat only various forms of meat, poultry, or fish.
Where are you going to get a new Quetzalcoatl, Marroquin?
A most incisive question, Lord Tenatio.
Don't go looking at me, Doc. I am not getting turned into a ghoul. Sorry, guys. And anyway, Teresa told me about Quetzalcoatl. He's a fair-skinned dude. In case you haven't noticed, I'm not.
Marroquin's top aides were absent again. Though their primary current duty appeared to be foreign god wrangler, they had other responsibilities as well.
Of little importance. Your aspect would be a tall, light-skinned man with pale eyes and a fair beard.
Definitely not me. Sounds insipid with due respect to my friends here. Anyway, I thought his aspect was that freight train-sized snaky thing with the feathers.
Oh, no, no, no. That's a psionic projection. It's a different phenomenon altogether. But put yourself at ease, friend Grant. While you definitely possess a sufficiently emphatic character to be invested with godhood, your personality type is far from compatible with Quetzalcoatl. Despite the manifestation you saw, which after all constituted his own flowery sacrifice and nothing typical of him, Quetzalcoatl truly is foremost a healing god.
Also highly intellectual, which, while you're a highly intelligent man, Grant, you're most definitely not.
Thank you.
And also, from my studies, I get the impression that the feathered serpent persona is, well, more than a little self-important.
True enough. So you see, most highly esteemed Grant, you're in no danger of being selected for the role.
Careful with all that esteemed Grant noise, Doc. You're starting to sound way too much like Lakesh.
Suddenly, three sets of eyes, gray, emerald green, and red, turn to stare intently at Grant.
What? What'd I say?
The blue eyes opened. The four Cerberus exiles gathered around the clinic bed sighed in unison. The eyes moved from one to another.
Why, my very dear friends, you seem relieved I have survived. This is an unlooked-for honor on top of my elevation to godhead.
Yeah, well, don't let it go to your head, Lakesh.
Well, it would appear that your sojourn in the Valley of Mexico hasn't diluted your comedic talents. Is it safe to sit up, Dr. Marroquin?
Of course, great Lord Quetzalcoatl.
Marroquin pressed his hands together and bowed. So did Ernesto, Teresa, and the crowd of techs hanging in the background.
Go lightly on that action, will you?
Lakesh sat up. He was wearing an open-backed hospital-style gown.
But why, friend Kane? I could easily grow used to such treatment.
Exactly.
Marroquin consulted his wrist chron.
Do you feel well, Lord? The sun will be up soon. You must appear to the people as soon as possible. We need to prepare your speech.
I feel quite well, thank you. Invigorated. Still, my good Dr. Marroquin, I had expected to receive at least some kind of course of instruction and, dare I say, a breaking-in period before I commenced my godly duties.
You got it. Good half hour, at least.
You get the same treatment the rest of us did, Lakesh, which is to be thrown into the deep end to see if you sink or swim. The only god training is on the job.
Yeah. With great powers come great pains in the ass. Speaking of which, somebody cover the new Lord Quetzalcoatl with a robe before he stands up, or learn the wrath of the sun god firsthand.
At sunrise, the new Quetzalcoatl made his public debut from the ramparts above the Institute's main gates, which, despite being painted with festive plumed serpents and other traditional images, were stressed concrete and would bounce a tank. Although armed goons were kept out of sight, everybody in Tenochtitlan knew Quetzalcoatl had his own elite cadre of knights, as well as conventional sec men, but the open display of guns did not suit his persona. Tonatiuh and Chalchihuitlicue discreetly backed him up on the podium, ostensibly to show respect to the returning savior of the city. Grant, meanwhile, was happily ensconced behind the scope of a Barrett 50-caliber sniper's rifle, guaranteed to shoot even a god, up to at least Tlaloc, if not Huitzilopochtli himself, inside out, up on the rooftop of a nearby office building with a commanding view of the gate and immediate environs. Itzapapalotl prowled nearby to provide him security while he was lost in the glass, and not all the helicopters circling a discreet distance overhead were newsbirds. The Tlian Tlapayan throng, never a hard house for the feathered serpent anyway, turned out to just cheer and offer up many gritos, as if it were Cinco de Mayo, still a favorite holiday hereabouts. A raid out of Talocan was feared by Don Exildo and the other paid warriors on the Institute's staff. But the combat action stayed where it was, crunching gamely through the streets clicks away toward city's center. Although the sun did shine a friendly red eye on proceedings, beneath a fairly serious pall of overcast, a desultory drizzle trailed down. It did nothing to dampen the occasion. Quetzalcoatl in aspect, looking not that different than Lakesh had when he'd enjoyed rejuvenation, compliments of Sam the Imperator, spoke fluent Spanish at the masses. Neither Kane nor Bridget knew whether he actually spoke the language before his investiture. Despite the fact that Lakesh as Quetzalcoatl had a voice that boomed over the land at an incredible volume, Kane tuned out the speech. Bridget later assured him it was mostly Gandhi warmed over, with a few touches of Martin Luther King Jr. Kane, who scarcely knew who either man was, just grunted. Having opened to rave reviews, Quetzalcoatl then did pose a problem to his security detail. The crowd had laid eyes upon the returning god, as had anyone in Tenochtitlan with a TV tuned to the Institute's broadcast band. But he still needed to get out among the people.
What, and commit miracles?
You've got to quit thinking like a magistrate, Kane.
I am a magistrate.
Kane, you don't commit miracles.
You got that right.
I don't mean you, you. I mean you as in one. Forgive me for speaking colloquial English.
At least it's English. How are we supposed to keep him alive if he's wandering around pressing flesh and kissing babies? What if somebody shanks him?
Do not forget Quetzalcoatl has formidable powers.
Marroquin appeared behind them in a pavilion that had been set up by the wall just inside the gate, to which Quetzalcoatl and retinue had repaired when his initial speech was done. Marroquin and Lakesh had mixed like water into water, much too well. They lashed the speech together between them in 15 minutes.
Although he is a god of peace, he can defend himself against minor attack. And of course he has his knights, who will likewise accompany him when he issues forth. We need you to secure him against assaults on a higher energy level.
That's what I really want to hear.
I have to admit, I've been wondering, just how does Quetzalcoatl feel about the person who, well, was responsible for him having to find a fresh incarnation?
Such hesitation was unlike the usually forthright Bridget. Kane put it down to her relative lack of experience as a deicide.
He feels, on the whole, profound relief. Indeed, a measure of gratitude to you for releasing his former associate from the torment of irreversible dementia, not to mention preventing substantial loss of life. Lakesh looked like himself, though dressed in a skirt of green quetzal feathers, with a cloak of the same held over his shoulders by a gold chain.
Of course, even though I am sharing my mental space with this other entity at the moment, nothing he could do could ever hope to diminish the esteem and affection in which I hold my beloved Bridget. And you too, to be sure, friend Kane.
That's easy to say, since you drew one of maybe about 2 Aztec deities who aren't vindictive sons of bitches.
Kane wondered how his drinking buddy Wewecoyotl was doing. He hadn't seemed the vindictive kind, although he was a son of a bitch.
You might be surprised. So we shall pray you aren't. And Bridget, may I say how lovely you look in your guise as the Lady of the Jade Skirt? Divinity quite becomes you, although I regret that you have not chosen to be altogether authentic in your garb.
Lakesh! I'm frankly shocked that you, of all people, would attempt to sleaze a look at my breasts.
No, no, you misunderstand me, good heavens. It is only that it seems out of character for one of your meticulous training and inclination.
Uh-huh.
Kane patted Lakesh's shoulder.
Let it go, Lakesh. This is not an argument you can possibly win. Trust me on this one.
The miracle tour was another smashing success. They made a triumphal procession toward the center of town, although Marroquin told Kane they would not try to force entry into Talakan unless the two caved completely, a contingency the White Coat didn't foresee. The Knights of the Quetzal and Blue Macaw were out in force for this one, riding in the forefront of the motorcade on their powered trikes, marching front and back and all sides of Quetzalcoatl's vehicle, a long, white, open-topped wag with red upholstery and strange fins swept up from the rear corners. Kane was riding just in front in an open-topped Hummer sporting a 50-caliber machine gun on a pintle mount. Bridget rode in an open wag right behind Quetzalcoatl's astonishing ride, and Grant and Domi perched on a 4-wheeled armored car behind that. The idea was to spread out the heavy hitters so that a lucky strike wouldn't nail them all. Pretty much all the Quetzalcoatl faction's fleet of gunships orbited back over Tlian-Tlapayan, ready to respond to any Talokan play. Indeed, it seemed to Kane that Marroquin, possibly in cahoots with Lakesh, was positively begging the loyalists to attack, which meant that Lakesh was acting with a not particularly characteristic boldness. Unless he had a lot higher estimation of Quetzalcoatl's gifts than Kane did. Kane was decidedly unimpressed with the feathered serpent's demonstrated ability to kill everybody within 100 yards. especially since Kane and just about everybody he cared about on Earth were within 100 yards of Ground Zero right now. He didn't think Lakesh would be willing to waste his ace operatives if things got dicey, but then he had never, in his most fevered imaginings, envisioned Lakesh riding through the streets of an old-fashioned spread-out ville, waving to cheering crowds and pausing now and again to heal the sick. Yes, and even raise the dead. That was in Quetzalcoatl's job description, too, it turned out, although it only worked on reasonably fresh and intact chills. Given how hipped everyone was on death hereabouts, Kane was a little surprised that would even be considered desirable. He displayed that particular ability at an aid station in a storefront a little over half a click from the forward edge of the battle area. Way too close, especially since the fighting kept trudging slowly but inexorably closer. A circle had been cleared around a bier made out of sandbags, upon which was laid the body of a young Tlian Tlapayan Sekman who had taken a round through the heart. He looked very young, and mostly asleep, clad only in his urban camo pants and boots. While media types flashed pictures past the cordon of knights holding them at bay, Quetzalcoatl strode grandly up to the dead kid. He was in his tall, vaguely Aryan-looking aspect, and wearing a garish feather headdress. From near the front of the store, Kane leaned his head toward Bridget's, being careful not to entangle his own goofy headdress with hers.
You think this is a setup?
I have no idea what to think. I don't feel confident saying anything is impossible at this point.
Quetzalcoatl laid his hands on the boy's chest. The hole healed as if by itself. A breathless moment, and then the young fighter's eyelids fluttered once and opened up. Quetzalcoatl helped him sit up, and everybody in the place dropped to one knee with heads bowed to hail the plumed serpent. Except Kane and Bridget.
Screw it. We're gods, too. Plus, I'm not bending the knee to Lakesh. As it is, it's gonna take the lifetime of the solar system before his ego shrinks back to its normal inflated proportions once he gets back to human.
If he ever does.
What's going on?
Nothing much. Lakesh reanimated a dead kid is all.
Now that's something.
Domi and Grant were keeping watch out in the street. Somebody had to, and Domi, being a naked kind of goddess, had not been deemed precisely suitable to attend the great event itself. Although she was highly popular with the crowd, despite looking like a living statue.
Yeah, there'll be no living with him now. Can we go home?
To everybody's relief, they did just that. Not back to Cerberus, of course, but right back to the Institute to take stock and let the Quetzalcoatl propaganda machine make what it could of the god's return to the city. A great celebration had been laid on in a dining hall on the ground floor of the compound's central step pyramid. Everybody knew it was premature to be celebrating final victory, but consensus was that the corner had been turned. The plumed serpent had returned in triumph to the capital, to the acclaim of the multitudes, and Talokan would have to swallow its pride and treat with him. Even Kane and Grant started to unwind, just a little. After all, they had dared their enemies to take a poke at them, and those enemies had passed.
Maybe the optimists are right this time. As Baptiste told me at the resurrection today, anything's possible. Okay, I'm wrong.
Celebrant screamed as a gunship made a pass right at them, its chin gun winking flame. The windows bulged in at the impacts, but actually held. Watching from the great window, Kane felt very cold. He sensed warmth beside him and looked down to see Bridget.
Correct me if I'm wrong. We just left most of our own troops out in the city, right?
You nailed it.
Several inbound choppers blossomed into flame, oddly colorless through the glass and against the gray sky. The Institute mustered some potent anti-aircraft, judging by the sound of full-dress Vulcan Phalanx minigun turrets. Given the rough-and-ready nature of Valley theology as well as politics, it was small surprise. Grant took a bite from his sticky bun.
There's not enough troops out there, and most of our birds are planted on the ground and getting serviced and refueled after our little extravaganza earlier.
I'm no strategist, but if those choppers are filled with, say, Huitzilopochtli and Tezcatlipoca and the rest of Talokan's heavy hitters, backed up by their knights...
Helicopters had begun to land.
We die, looks like.
Friends!
They turned. Lakesh strode toward them with Marakin by his side.
It would appear we have been caught off guard.
Maybe. I bet I can take down 20 knights before they chill me. What are you guys in for?
All might not be lost.
He's right. We still have two interphasers. The one that brought Domi and Grant and the one Lakesh used. We can get back to Cerberus with, well, a few of the key Quetzalcoatl people.
No. We're still gods, remember? Cerberus can't sustain us and can't put us back the way we were.
Enemy knights leaped from the assault craft. Energy beams stabbed back and forth. Men fell. Many more charged, mouths wide in unheard war cries.
I think I'll take Domi's bet, except I don't care about 20. I only want to take one with me. We teleposhed her.
All right, then. Let's ride.
Domi phase-shifted, tore off her smock, and flexed her claws.
Wait!
Everyone turned to look at Maruki. Ernesto and Teresa now stood with him, looking like fawns caught in headlights. Most of the hall had cleared out now as people ran, some to battle stations, others for the most secure hiding places available, or looking for covert ways out of the doomed institute.
You were selected for battle wisdom as well as prowess. Is suicide the best counterstroke you can come up with?
Kane's cheeks burned, and for a moment, Donatio flared forth in full rage.
You dare to contradict
me? Easy, Donatio.
Kane looked at Bridget and saw her aspect was upon her.
Any chance of reinforcements?
I fear not. We have reports that the Tarokan forces, including many gods, have launched an all-out ground assault led by Tlaloc. Our whole strength is engaged.
One entire 5-yard-long armaglass panel sagged in and shattered as a plasma bolt struck it. A rush of warm air flooded in, heavy with the smell of diesel fuel and burned bodies and incipient rain. Outside, the defenders were being pushed back, those who weren't already looking up at the sky. The others looked at Domi, fearing to see madness in her blood-hued eyes.
Don't you see? They're going for the trope, but they've left their own asses flapping in the breeze!
Hold tight!
Punch's voice sounded through the earpiece Kane held clamped to the side of his head. The heavily laden gazelle lurched upward from the yard. Sitting across from Kane in the rear of the bird with four knights in battle regalia, Domi literally snarled like a jaguar as an eagle knight appeared right in front of them, just beyond the sweep of the main rotor, hoisting a bulky plasma rifle to his shoulder. Despite adrenaline fever and immediate awareness of the burning force lines winding around him and through the meridians, the prana channels of his body, Kane could do nothing. His solar flare would flash blast cockpit and pilots alike. This was a utility gazelle, not a death bird-like dedicated gunship. But a minigun was bolted beneath the portside stub wing, and a strap-on ammo pack counterbalanced it to starboard. Unlike the death bird's center-mounted guns, its recoil tried to twist the bird counterclockwise, opposite the spin of the main rotor overhead. A skilled pilot could keep the ship pointed the right way by easing off the tail rotor pedal when firing, allowing recoil torque to compensate that of the main blades, but had to keep the bursts short or they would spin the ship the opposite direction. Poncha was very skilled indeed. Her burst was very short. The effect on the elite Talokan warrior was as if a plastic bag filled with blood and assorted chunks had been dropped to the concrete apron from a very great height. Muddy red droplets splayed across the windscreen, and then the bird was up and away, curving north and west and low as if running for the mountains. Behind them, 5 or 6 choppers burned on the apron, only one a Talokan. A dogfight roared and tumbled overhead. At least a few Quetzalcoatl jocks had gotten their birds up to rumble with the attackers. And some were clearly bugging out. Kane felt a red flash of fury at the cowards, and it wasn't all Tenatia or Don Pedro. Domi gazed at his face and read it like a computer screen.
Be grateful! They're covering us and the rest!
But not well enough. Looking out the viewport in the portside door above Domi's left shoulder, he saw another gazelle rise up, start away, shudder to shell impacts. With smoke erupting from the big single exhaust nozzle, it rocketed straight upward 15 yards. Then the main rotor broke into whirling black shards. The chopper dropped like an anvil and vanished into a balloon of yellow flame.
Grant, Lakesh, Baptiste, respond.
I'm fine. Still with you, Kane.
About half a click east over a little patch of lake. Already clear of the swarm, looks like. Oh, Kane, that gazelle? That was Maragine's ship.
Kane traded grimaces with Domi, who was hearing the same on her own unit.
Nobody's getting out of that incinerator. But he told us what we need to know.
I hope the crash killed everybody instantly.
Kane knew that wasn't usually how it went down, although they had free-fallen almost 100 feet. No point telling her how likely it was the occupants burned alive. Not when the chances were really good it would be them frying and dying in their own grease in just a couple of short minutes. Kane doubted even Tonatiuh could dump that much heat into the energy whirls in short enough order to do more than prolong the pain. The Talokan warcraft showed no interest in them. They had the upper hand, but way too much on their plates to bother anybody who was clearly running. Marukin had just gotten unlucky. Either his bird had been overkilled by somebody else's skyfight, or a Talokan deathbird driver had caught a shot and decided not to risk letting a possible foe get airborne. Like the other two gazelles, the Chief Whitecoat's bird had mounted a bolted-on Gatling.
We're clear!
He only just heard Punch's words, tiny and tinny. He could still tell her tone was dead calm. Combat chopper drivers were like armor wag jocks in that regard. They ran with the certain knowledge that whenever you took your machine in harm's way, you stood the chance of being cremated without the luxury of dying first.
Roger that. Let's go downtown.
The bird pitched forward and accelerated. Domi was naked but for the harness of her shoulder rig. The four knights crammed in with them took no notice. They had more urgent things on their minds. Baptiste had told Kane that back in the heyday of the cult of psychotherapy, people calling themselves scientists actually believed no human drive was stronger than sex. Yeah, Kane thought. Try not dying. Taloned black hands clutched a scope laser rifle to Domi like a teddy bear. She wasn't Earth's best rifle shot, and Itza Papalotl had little patience with a style of chilling that didn't even get an enemy's guts all wound around her in the process. But even Grant's plasma rifle didn't have a great range, nor did the Knight's small arms, and they needed somebody to discourage snipers. The laser whip was easy to hit with, anyway. No recoil, no bullet drop, just point and click. Poncha had curved the bird around the stricken institute in a wide arc and lined out for Talokan. The three main buildings of Valley, Church, and State already looked huge through the front windscreen. Craning to peer out the port on his own side, Kane could just see the Institute compound. A whole lot of smoke was drifting skyward from a whole lot of places, but the Institute was a big place, and more than somewhat slightly hardened. It would take Talokan days to pry out all of even the rump force of defenders, even if they threw in everybody they had, gods and mere humans alike. He felt a twinge for Teresa. The hybrid girl was such an odd blend of spiky competence and childlike vulnerability. But she and Ernesto had their own bodyguard of knights, and if they had followed their now late leader's firm instructions, they were locked in a deep vault beneath the Institute where the invaders might never even find them. Complete with easy access to subterranean escape tunnels that would let them get clear even if the two dropped the whole place on top of them with demo charges. The prior Quetzalcoatl, Morale, the exile's hybrid leader, betrayer and betrayed, had been well paranoid, peace god or not. Which, of course, was why he'd escaped to spend the past 3 decades in one more exile. Kane sat back in his seat.
Huitzilopochtli. Bastard. I never even laid eyes on the puke.
Good. You'd have gone for him and blown the whole damn plan, men.
Domi had produced a sautéed axolotl strip on a stick from somewhere that didn't bear thinking about and was chewing it happily. She seemed less stressed or fatigued by wearing her aspect than the others, even though it changed her body more. The obsidian butterfly persona fit the feral girl like skin, her lethal appetites in flawless accord with Domi's own. And of course she got to drink down the life forces of those she slew far more up close and personal than the others, thus recharging faster. But she still has to spend her nights in the same vats we do, Kane reminded himself. Or her nervous system will burn itself out, her own metabolism run into overdrive and consume her body from within. He hoped again the white coats weren't lying when they claimed the process was reversible. As if we're likely to live long enough to find out. In its way, it was a reassuring thought. Several choppers floated in the sky above the vast central plaza. Just one or two could possibly be gunships. Between the strike on Quetzalcoatl HQ and the street fight passing below Kane's ship even now, Talokan had shot its whole wad this afternoon. The other craft were no doubt TV birds, whose crews were hoping something newsworthy would happen that didn't require them to fly into a sky filled with flaming death to capture it.
Get ready to jump! Taking fire already!
Their route took them past the Parliament building from the north. Kane could see figures on the roof who seemed to be shooting at them. Just small arms, it looked like, subguns and long blasters. Nothing hit the bird, which was good, because nothing was exactly what the thin hull would stop. The pyramid's top was crowded with knights, plumed dignitaries, and the loathsome priests of sacrifice in their rotting blood body paint and human membrane do-rags. Evidently, the two planned a major bloodletting to celebrate the downfall of their foes, which there was in plenty on and around the altar of the gods, just a little ahead of schedule. Poncha's minigun buzzed repeatedly, scouring the pyramid's apex like a fire hose. Vectoring in from the northwest, the chopper carrying Grant and the new Quetzalcoatl, or same old Lakesh, added its cleansing fire to theirs. The 30 or so men waiting on the pyramid died with no chance to defend themselves or escape.
Rest in pieces.
Poncha dove the ship toward its objective. Lakesh's bird got there ahead of Poncha's, but the chopper jock in Kane could sense her irritation with that in the way she waved off and flew a holding pattern around the pyramid, not circling, but serpentining and juking up and down, making it hard on the enemy gunners, who were no doubt shooting at them even now, but Kane couldn't see anybody actually doing it. The other ship flared into hover with its skids a yard or so above the black altar. The knights hopped out. One put a foot on a loop of greasy purple gut, slipped, and fell. Grant jumped next, more cautiously, then reached up to help Lakesh down. The aging white coat had his aspect upon him and looked and moved like an athletic young warrior god, albeit a peaceful one, mostly. Once its divine cargo was clear, the chopper shot straight into the air to quickly clear the way for Poncha. And a hammer blow struck her chopper with a noise like the sky breaking open. The cabin filled with dark, choking smoke and a blast of cool air. Waving his hand before his face, Kane saw the windscreen was gone. The co-pilot slumped in his seat. Something in Poncha's posture wasn't right, although her hands gripped the joystick and her feet were working the pedals, hard to judge from the way the craft obviously wanted to drift in air. The instrument panel was a blaze of red emergency lights.
Sam! Out now!
Domi and Kane opened their doors, then, as one, sat back to let the knights egress first. They had merely human powers to preserve them if the bird gave up the ghost. Not if, but when. Kane wasn't half the Deathbird driver Grant was, but he was a seasoned pilot. The damage was visibly bad, and that much red on the board meant a mechanism as intricate as a helicopter was already dead. It still flew, under control of at least a sort, but it was clearly just looking for a place to lie down. The humans jumped free. Baptiste and Grant both clamored for Kane's attention, but he didn't absorb their words. Beneath him, he felt the chopper begin to rise, slowly, inexorably.
Go, now, for the love of God!
Poncha crossed herself. She was a closet monotheist who still held to the valley's other old-time religion, Roman Catholicism. The ruling gods neither tolerated nor suppressed it. They just ignored it. It was just there, like the lake and the quakes and the Smokies all around, and a whole lot less bother. Kane registered none of that now. Standing in the open door, what he did register was that the pyramid top was a good 10 yards below and falling. Nuke shit. He and Domi were dead if they stayed in the bird, but how much good could they do with ankles shattered to powder and thigh bones driven like impaling stakes up into their bowels? Domi tackled him from behind. They both shot right out into space.
Stoop! We're gods!
He got his legs beneath him. The girl let go. The pyramid rushed up and smacked him in the soles of his sandals. By sheer trained reflex, he let his knees buckle to the impact, dropped, tucked a shoulder, rolled. He lay on his back to see Domi crouched on the altar above him, also surprised to be alive. He lay still. He felt as if a mule had kicked him up under the jaw. He felt as if a mule had kicked him all over. It took the full, awful majesty of Tenatio's will to suck even a molecule of air back into his body. He was alive, and he could still feel his legs and feet. They hurt, but he could feel them. Gods. Right. Superhuman strength and all. Evidently structural, too. Grant loomed above him like a black colossus in his shadow armor. He reached down a giant hand.
No time to take a nap.
Their hands clasped, forearm to strong forearm. An engine whined overhead as Grant hauled his partner to his feet. Poncha had got her bucking, swaying, dying bird pointed the way she wanted, 200 yards above the pyramid. Its motor was sheathed in flame and orange hell glare shone out the open door. She tipped the whirlywag's snout down and into a long, shallow power dive right toward the roof of the black house, on which small humanoid forms could be seen. The shot that killed the gazelle had come from there, or so she seemed to have judged. She was probably right. Two more backpack anti-aircraft missiles streaked toward her, sprouting long tails of white smoke from pinpoints of blue-white fire. Both shot harmlessly past the chopper to explode somewhere over the city, behind the watchers' backs. They didn't have enough flight distance to guide on the chopper, even though their IR seeker heads had a huge, fat target to look at. By the time it hit, right beyond the edge of the roof, the machine was nothing but a raging orange comet of fire, which splashed clear across the roof of the Black House, engulfing dozens of defenders. The lucky ones were crushed instantly thereafter by hurtling wreckage or ripped asunder by shredded blades. Several fell or jumped, miniature meteors themselves, the black glass facade reflecting the light of their descending, self-contained pyres. Kane drew his sword from its loose leather sheath slung across his back. It was undamaged, despite the fact he'd landed on it. The resin impregnation of the glass blades and flat hardwood handle definitely performed to spec. He held the weapon up in salute.
Goodbye, Poncho.
Awe atque wale.
Lakesh had organized the 12 knights with them into a defensive periyard around the sacrificial platform. He hadn't done a half-bad job. The warrior who had fallen down had not managed to injure himself. Behind the altar itself stood a stone pavilion, which served as backdrop to the festivities and also concealed an entrance to the pyramid's hollow innards. Domi moved up onto its flat roof with her scoped laser rifle and a pair of 8x21 micro binocs. Grant, looking up at Domi's naked body, couldn't help thinking of gargoyles.
Domi, you're pretty exposed up there.
I got quick reflexes, and I got a 360 view. Threats can come from lots of directions.
She's right. It's not as if we're not all just a little bit at risk here.
Gentlemen, ladies, if I may direct your attention to the Black House.
Burning fuel from Ponch's gazelle was still smeared down the front of the Black House for maybe 20 yards, like luminous graffiti. A few bits of wreckage lay beneath it on the plaza, but most of the debris had stayed on the roof. Men poured into the plaza from the Black House. They wore black uniforms that included black hoods or ski masks. Impossible to tell at this distance. They carried machine pistols in gauntleted hands.
Wouldn't you just know the priests in white coats would have their own sect men?
Some regular Talokan sect men and even a handful of knights were in the plaza below. Presumably, a new security contingent had been posted to the charnel house that was the parliament building. Also, no doubt, there were various fighters securing the interior of the pyramid beneath their feet, including gods, so Kane had to assume.
Allow me.
Lakesh strode to the front of the topmost level, toward the Black House. He raised his hands.
Priests and scientists and warriors of the Black House, hear me. I am Quetzalcoatl. I have returned to reclaim my rightful place in the ruling councils of Tenochtitlan and the Valley.
Whoa. I didn't know he brought a loudspeaker with him. How do they get that kind of volume out of a little hideaway unit like that?
I'm not using a loudspeaker. Nor did I in my inaugural address. It turns out this is one of my new powers.
Some wannabe blood drinker down in the plaza shouldered a long blaster. Sorry.
Quetzalcoatl raised his hands high.
Cease! Let there be no more contention. I will not be denied, but I wish no more blood to be shed within the precincts of our holy city. Lay down your weapons, and you will not be harmed, my children.
A whole volley of gunfire crackled from the black mass. No bullets came near them. They were much too far for accurate shooting with submachine guns firing handgun loads, and people blasting at an upward angle almost always shot low. Obedient to the orders implicit in Lakesh's words, Domi held her fire.
So be it!
Quetzalcoatl made a sweeping gesture of his hands, as if gathering something and casting it toward the Black House. The great building's glass front exploded in a shower of black razor snow. It fell with deceptive slowness onto the Sekhmen who had streamed into the plaza. The watchers on the pyramid could hear the screams as falling fragments sliced through bodies, limbs, and heads.
I willingly harm no one, but if my hand is forced, I will raise it to defend myself.
Impressive.
For the moment, at least, no more shots were fired. The surviving Black House troops were too busy avoiding or surviving the descending shards to worry about the interlopers. However, plenty of enemies remained down there who hadn't been within the glassfall footprint. Brigid stepped up to the front of the platform.
My turn.
At the base of the broad, steep stairs leading up the pyramid from the plaza, the Via Dolorosa trodden by tens of thousands of human sacrifices, a wisp of white appeared in the air. It rolled, roiled, and grew like smoke from a fire. Brigid's hands were raised and eyes tight shut.
Now that's just spooky.
Grant held his plasma rifle at the ready.
What's she doing?
The white cloud began to radiate outward across the plaza. Some of the Sekhmen fled its approach, back toward the Parliament building.
They're afraid it's a Chipe-Totec kind of trick. Poison gas, maybe.
It would appear she's causing atmospheric moisture to condense in the form of fog.
The white stuff now filled the great plaza and surrounded the bases of the three cyclopean buildings to the height of a couple of stories. Bridget opened her eyes and smiled as she looked upon her handiwork.
Voila! Instant smokescreen.
Good job. Now they'll have trouble shooting at us.
And now we got trouble shooting at them.
Hey, there's plenty more of them than us. I don't think there's going to be much of a problem unless they try to rush the pyramid or snipe at us from one of the other buildings. Domi...
Oh, what'd you say, Chief?
Keep up the good work. Ketsa, Lakesh, why don't you and Bridget kind of drift back under the overhang there, just in case? And you two back there, Ocelotl and Ant Bear, keep a real close watch on that door.
Both knights of the Quetzal and Blue Macaw were armed with plasma rifles, which ought to give a good jolt to anyone, even Tezcatlipoca, who poked his snout through the door, Cain hoped.
Right now, this plan's got more holes in it than a slagger's skivvies.
Yep, it sucks. Only it sucks less than anything else available.
Classic one percenter.
Again.
Time to stir up the ants.
Cain hoisted his shield, then drew his sword, which he had thrust through his belt. He looked around the bottom of the dome of cloud.
I see a death bird. A couple of good rockets takes us all out in a blaze of glory.
I don't think they'll choose to play it that way, but let's reduce the element of chance.
He aimed the sword and felt for the fiery lines of force. White brilliance drew a line across the sky, culminating in a bright yellow sphere wreathed in black smoke where the gunship had been.
Whoa! I could have never made that shot with this plasma rifle.
Well, that's why it pays to have a god on your team. Let's see how good the news crew's telephoto lens is.
He let the obsidian-edged sword swing from a leather thong around his wrist and pointed to the TV helicopter. Then he rolled his hand, palm up, extended his forefinger, and curled it back toward his palm in a come-here gesture, thrice repeated. After a moment in which Cain considered sending a solar flare across the civilian helo's bow, it turned, dipped its nose, and descended toward the pyramid. Then it stopped.
Domi, don't be pointing that thing at him. We want him to come this way.
Aw, man!
Domi aimed the laser long blaster elsewhere.
Perhaps if you could muster a bit of a halo, it might show to advantageous effect on the viewing public screens.
Yeah, full body radiance, like a medieval painting.
What, everybody has a suggestion now on how to run the god business?
Just your fellow gods and goddesses.
I'm an action god, not a public relations god.
Cain concentrated briefly and was rewarded by the air immediately surrounding his body, and even the extravagant feathers atop his helmet beginning to glow yellow, a really, really bright yellow.
Little blinding up here!
Oh, whoops.
Cain reduced the output. He gestured at the news helicopter again. It resumed its wary approach.
Doesn't anybody else think this whole thing with the clown suits and all is just a little silly?
If you hadn't just zapped a gunship out of the sky a click away with a wooden sword, I'd be laughing harder than anybody right now.
The helicopter descended to hover somewhat above the apex and about 100 yards away.
Can you hear me? If so, then flash your landing lights.
They did.
Are you broadcasting this?
The lights winked again obediently.
Then hear me, Tenochtitlan and Talokan. I am Tonatiuh, god of the sun. With me is Lord Quetzalcoatl. He has returned to restore peace and freedom to the people of the city and all of the valley. I am his champion. Should Talokan wish to contest the plumed serpent's right of return, I, Tonatiuh, do hereby challenge the war god Huitzilopochtli to personal combat to vindicate that right.
He let the sword, which he'd been brandishing with what he hoped was appropriate theatricality, hang from its thong and folded his arms across his gilded polycarbonate breastplate. The helicopter fled to a safe distance.
Bravo! You're a natural-born politician, Cain.